Ah, is that better? See, I can't hear you, so yeah, you have to either nod or you have to shake your head. Yes, better? All right. Don't worry, it was useless, so let me just say it again really quickly. All right, did you get my heresies? Because I enjoyed my heresies. I'll go through that briefly again. All right. The community doesn't need books. The community doesn't need information. The community doesn't need buildings. That libraries aren't about books and information and buildings. What the community needs are what those things enable, right? So it's not about books. It's about what people learn and how they enjoy and how they understand the world from reading. It's not about information. It's about whether that information helped them get a job or participate in democratic process or even connect with family and friends. It's not about buildings. It's about a place where people can come together that's neutral, that's not inundated with advertisement. It's the third space, what have you. So my point about all of this is that when we talk about identifying community needs, and particularly when we talk about advocacy, what we really need to think about is what are we trying to enable people to do? Because that's the story that we really want to be part of it. So taking a pause, is this better audio now? Okay. So it comes back again to the idea of we're problem solvers. We train as problem solvers, right? I mean, I've worked so many years with the reference librarians. You know the reference librarians that I'm talking about. These are the reference librarians that are not satisfied to give you one answer. They're satisfied to give you 300 answers, and they will chase the patron outside the door still giving them answers. They will stalk them, find them on Facebook, send them messages until, by God, they are informed and referred, right? This is what we do. We love this. The problem is that when you look at a community and you identify those needs and those problems that we need to do, the problem is if you keep promoting yourself, if you keep advocating for your importance based on the problems that communities have, you keep reminding the communities that they have problems. And eventually the community doesn't want to hear it anymore. We had a situation, we have a school of social work that would go into inner city Syracuse and it would be there to help. Now notice the quotes, the air quotes, very important. And the reason is because they really felt, you know, here are all these problems, we're going to go help. The community asked Syracuse University in no uncertain terms if we would stop helping them. Because the thing is, it's like, we're tired of being told we're broken. We're tired of being told that you come down here with these grand ideas. And let's face it, when 18 and 19 year old white kids come down here and tell us how to make things better, we don't really appreciate that often. Right? And so when we do things like, well, we can help you because your early pre-K reading isn't working. We can help you because students don't know how to use cited peer-reviewed materials. We can help you. What you're really saying is we can help you because you suck. We can help you because you stink. We can help you. And right, eventually people get tired of hearing this. And so saying things like, you need us because you need books, is crazy. It's a deficit model, and we need to get out of that idea. So it's not that the community doesn't need books. It doesn't need information. It doesn't need buildings. It needs what those things enable. It needs to imagine and dream. It needs to participate and engage in democratic process. It needs to build a thriving economy that provides equity to all involved. It needs a place and a space to come together and speak outside of the influence of lots of other factors. That's where we talk about advocating. I'm going to skip the beautiful videos about yoga pants, but it was hilarious, and I'm sorry for the feedback because I was just dying laughing. But anyway, if you went to ALA, if you've been watching the blogosphere, what you've been hearing increasingly is community-focused, that libraries need to be focused on the community, not the collection. Now, I think there's a big argument to be made that we've always been community-focused, but now we're really looking at it in a very different way. We're looking at the idea that the community itself is in a different state than when many of our ethics and messaging and services were put together. For example, when public libraries first sprang out, and, you know, a couple of centuries ago when academic libraries were really getting going, we lived in an information-scarce environment. We lived in a place where books were expensive, where bringing them together made a lot of sense because we could pool resources and bring together and build this resource. We don't live in an information-scarce environment any longer. So does that messaging still make sense? Does that outreach still make sense? The collecting might. We'll get back to that in a second. But the idea of how we're talking about it. What we're talking about in libraries, and we talk about a community focus, is we must move from transactions to relationships. We must move from the idea that a person, generic and privacy intact, walks into a building or comes to us virtually. We exchange something, a book, a material, an answer, a cataloging record, whatever, and they walk away. That's a transactional way of looking at things. And if you think for a moment, think about the statistics that you report to your state, to your faculty, to your city, to whatever community you're involved with. How many of those are about relationships, and how many of those are about transactions? Most things that you can count are about transactions. Gate counts, circulation, reference questions, web hits, database searches. We don't need to talk about those so much as we need to talk about, did they matter? If you want your gate count to go up, offer free candy to children. It will work. But I don't think that's necessarily fulfilling your mission. So we're talking about moving from transactions to relationships. Talking about moving the things like, I provided so much material to the school, to the school and I are engaged in increasing reading within the pre-K level. Right? We need to move from collections to connections. The idea that we have all of something, the idea that we have all the Harry Potters or all of these reference materials or the whole back issue of a journal, isn't as important as what those things do within the community. That who uses those resources? How do they use the resources? How does it affect them? How does it matter to them? And not only that, but how can, if you're interested in it and this person's interested in it, how can we bring you together and create a connection that hadn't existed before? Right? So to be community focused means two things that are rather frightening. And things that, in terms of continuing heresy, I'm going to continue my heretical statements. The first is that we must cede exclusive control of the library. We must give up the idea that the library is the infrastructure of the librarian. Now, it's easy to say, well, we already do that, Dave, because we have a faculty senate oversight committee, or we have a board of trustees, or we have principals, or we, you know, pick the parent organization and say, well, they're really in control. Oh, please. They're really in control because they do the MARC records. They're really in control because they decide when the doors open and close. The idea here is that we're not just talking about oversight, we're talking about in situation, everywhere, co-owning this with the community. And that can be very, very frightening. Because the first thing that happens is people say, well, what if they stink at it? Well, then we deal with it. Because let's face it, there are a few librarians that aren't necessarily good at everything as well. We have to talk about how can the community come together and decide how they work together. When someone comes together and say, I'm really interested in Japanese manga, rather than us say, well, let me look at our collection budget and see what we can purchase, and then we'll have to go through 12 years of purchasing, and I have to go in the back order of the catalog. Why can't we just say, see that shelf over there? Fill it up. It's all yours. But what happens? How do we index that? You don't. What if we catalog it? You don't. What if someone steals it? They know the risk, and if they're willing to take it on, they're willing to take it on. That idea of level of control where the community comes in and begins to share things can be scary, but ultimately, it's back into our mission. It's back into the idea of sharing control and helping that community do something. That the true power of a library and the true power of librarians is not in our ability to know it all or have it all, but it's into enabling the potential of our community members. It's the fact that because we were here at this date, at this time, in this place, this community got better. And how is what's better? Better is, once again, defined by that community. The second, another second additional piece of heresy I want to say, is in order for us to truly become community focused, we must kill the user. And I know that this may sound like a violent thing, but you'll have to excuse me for a moment because I have a rant to make. The rant to make is, while I think it's great that in library land we have adopted this notion of user, it's starting to drive me a little nuts. And it's driving me nuts for two reasons. One, because the concept is extremely limited, and two, it's out of date. It's like referring to people as, you know, referring to a mature woman as a groovy chick. I mean, it's just like antiquated and incorrect at the same time. It makes me flinch. So I want to give you a reason why I never want you to use the phrase user again. And there are other people who say that we should, but This is why I hate it. First of all, you have to understand that there's a history behind this. The history of sort of user orientation or user systems is that it grew out of when information science folks and computer folks were working with really old systems, right? Back when you had to do punch cards and hexadecimal codes and do, you know, or better yet, the whole sort of dialogue searching with the pluses and minuses and quotes and all of that. When systems were extremely constrained, you designed software and systems around the system. In other words, what you did was you made the system do what it could do best, and then you trained people to come in and work as if they were part of the system. And a lot of people got up and said, that's backwards. Particularly as computers become more useful, it's how we see a problem, how we understand a problem and work with the problem as a user of that system that's more important. If you don't speak my language, if you don't shape it around my needs, then, in fact, you know, it doesn't matter how good your index and algorithms are. And so it sounds really good. The problem is that if you look at that relationship between a system and a user, it's a really limited dialogue between a system and a user. And it's not that way anymore. So I can see you all here. I'm peeking. So this is the interactive portion of our day, even though I can't hear a thing. How many of you have smartphones? All right. How many of you have ever added an app to your smartphone? All right. Are you a user of that phone? Because in the original concept of a user, you would be a user of that phone. But the minute you add an app to it, you're doing something really un-user-like. You're starting to shape what your telecommunications experience is. I mean, think about it for a minute. You pick your favorite phone, right? So mine's the iPhone, whatever it is. What is this? It used to be a phone. Did you know that the average time on a telephone call went from 3 minutes down to 1 minute over the past 5 years? Do you realize that the majority of use of these things is now has nothing to do with voice and most of it's texting and data? That increasingly, these things are not what we would have called telephones. Right? So we're shaping and shifting these because that's not what this is anymore. What this is my mobile platform. Right? So you add card games. You add Angry Birds. You add, I'm sure, lots of business things as well. You know, and I can read documents and words and all of this stuff. You're not a user of this phone anymore. You're an orchestrator of this phone. You're a shaper of this phone. You're controlling what this phone does. That's not a simple dialogue between you and a phone. You're part, that's, how many people have done this? Somewhere in the conference, at some point, someone's going to do this. You got that app? You got to have this app. Oh, you got that app? Right? It becomes a social conversation, which is ironic because most of us use it in the corner of parties not to actually interact with anyone. But maybe that's just my dysfunction. The idea here is that this concept of a user, here's what the system can do, here's what the user then manipulates. And we begin to treat the user as if they're sort of a bag of heuristics that we can manipulate by pulling certain strings is out of date, right? Increasingly, user has become synonymous with consumer. User has become synonymous with customer. And all of that means the idea that someone comes in, they grab what they need, and they walk away. And I think that what we're talking about when we talk about libraries and communities is when someone comes and becomes part of the library. They become part of the collection. They become part of the vision. They become part of the workforce. They become part of marketing. That is not a user relationship. Remember, user comes from the word usury. And if you really love being used, that's fine. I personally much more enjoy being part of a community. So even those who champion this whole notion of user-based are abandoning it as too limited. And the problem is, and this is not a new problem because libraries have always loved the terminology, you know, word of the day, is we're looking for better terms but we don't have them, right? Customer. They're not our customers. Consumer. They're not consumers. I mean, yes, they consume, but they also produce and think and act and are willing to share. Well, what about prosumer? Ugh. Producer and consumer. I mean, that was just an attempt from a 2.0 land in a startup that no one paid attention to. I personally like the idea of member. When I was working with the Dallas Public Library, they actually liked the word neighbor. I thought that was great. Someone in an academic library said, well, can we call them student and faculty? I said, that sounds even better, right? Creators, what have you. Patron. As antiquated as that term is, I like patron even better than I like user. Because at least there's a sense of ownership in there, patronage, and some relationship. So my point of all of this, when we talk about our relationships with the community, we need to get out of the mindset that we are a service that people come and consume and walk away. Because I'll tell you what, if you want to look at that, how that plays out, look at a bookstore. Aren't you glad you didn't totally revamp your service to look exactly like Borders as they went out of business? Aren't you glad you didn't totally revamp it to look like Barnes & Noble as they are going out of business? Or videos looking like Blockbusters? Because when they close libraries, people pick it. When they close Blockbusters, people show up for the deals. That's a very different relationship, and it is not a consumer relationship. It is not a usury relationship. It is an intimate community relationship where you have members that contribute and work together. And so when you think about how do you work with members, right? When you think about how you work with consumers and users, it's make the interface good, make reduce friction, the idea of not having them think too much when they're using it, make it quick and easy. Well, isn't part of our responsibility actually having people stop and think about things? There's a whole huge industry and marketplace set up to allow people to consume without thinking. Right? There's a whole thing about how do you get people, you know, where do you put the boxes of cereal in the grocery store? Where do you put the gum for those purchases, those last minute impulse purchases? How do you, you know, sew up the market so that you can only get apps from Apple and Apple gets 30% of them and you make them 99 cents because at $1.05 suddenly you start thinking about, but 99 cents is cheap. Why do we buy gas that's $3.58 and not notice it's really $3.58.9, which means it's $3.60, right? This whole world is setting up to have people automatically consume. I think the value of libraries is to have people stop and think about not only consuming, but how to produce. And sometimes we need to slow people down. When it comes to privacy, how do we treat privacy? It's very vitally important to us. But what we do is we keep their privacy so important we don't even have them think about it. We don't even give them the option of thinking about it versus teaching them about it, having them think about it, having them apply privacy ideas not only with the library but on Facebook and at home and what they do. We teach a class, but do we actually show them what happens? Do we actually give them examples on a regular basis? So this idea that they're users or consumers, it's gone. What we want is a relationship with our community where they're neighbors and they're members and they're part of us. And as they improve, we improve. So there's a great example. Pew Trust just came out with a report looking at the Philadelphia Library. I can send you a URL. But they have this chart which shows here's the Free Library of Philadelphia and around it are all the services or all the different agencies within the city of Philadelphia they serve. So, for example, for the city human resources, they provide hard copy of job postings and assistance with the city jobs application system. Under the public health, they provide general health information, lectures on topics, healthy cooking classes. And they have a beautiful, wonderful diagram of how each service links them to the community. The one problem is it shows what the library does, shares out. It doesn't necessarily show what the community does to change the library. How were those services shaped? A lecture, was that good enough or not? The cooking classes, did it work or didn't it? The example is that in Canada, they had a system where the public library was working with the local food bank to distribute food to the needy. As they went in and evaluated what was happening, they found out that part of the problem with nutrition wasn't necessarily access to food. They were solving that problem, or at least working towards it. It was the fact that once these families had the food, they didn't know how to prepare it. They didn't know how to cook. They didn't know how to heat it up. They didn't do whatever. And so the library began offering cooking classes. So it was an example where the library was serving the community in partnership, but they heard back what was happening and shaped their own services around it. That's what communities do. That's what relationships do. If all the library said was we're going to offer lectures and pointers to health and human services, they wouldn't have been truly accomplishing what they were seeking, which was to make a difference in people's nutrition and health life. That requires listening. It requires a conversation. So I want you to think about the library and librarians not necessarily as a place, not necessarily as a collection, and not even as a bundle of services. I want you to think of the library as a platform for innovation and learning. The reason that the library is in our community and the benefit that it has is it provides a platform for the community improvement, for the community to learn and to come up with new ideas and to implement those ideas. So the first thing that you need to know about a platform is that it's not about lending, it's about sharing. Now, I know that sounds synonymous. What's the difference between lending and sharing? So what I want you to think about for a moment is a dinner party. You're going to throw a dinner party. So one model of throwing a dinner party is you put out the invite list and you invite 10 of your closest friends. And you spend all day in the kitchen and you come up with a beautiful view of the grocery store. You buy the food, you bring it, you prepare it, you plate it. They all sit around the table, you hand out the food, and everyone has a good party. Right? That's a lending model. It means that you have the resources and you're distributing the resources to those who need or want it. With me so far? Now imagine that those 10 people you invited their 10 closest friends to come with them. Well, now you're in trouble, right? Because you didn't buy food for 20. You didn't buy enough food. So what do? Well, either you have to take the food and cut the portions in half. Some have to go hungry. You have to rush around and hope that you have enough money to go back. And this lending model, if you think about libraries for a moment, this is the model that we are at now. Right? If someone wants another ebook, we have to go buy another license. If someone wants another physical book, we've got to go buy it. And we have a limited pot of money to do it. And that means the more people who show up, the more people who require a service, the more successful we are in marketing our services, the less lending we can do, the worse service they receive. We are in a no-win situation. Now, how do we try and solve that? Through consortia, right? So we try and link up to our fellow libraries so we can share and lend materials. But that would work great, except the other members of the consortium are solving the same problem. You're assuming that there's slack in the system, and there is a little slack. But increasingly what you're doing is you're actually taxing and adding more of this constraint on a limited resource. Now I want you to think about throwing a dinner party in a different way, in a sharing model. And it's the famous potluck. What you do is you invite 10 friends and you say, show up at this time and bring a dish to serve. If they invite 10 friends under the same conditions of bringing a dish to serve, the more people who show up, the more food you have to share, the more resources you have. Right? Now, there's still limited bottlenecks of resources, space in the house and the number of tables, but now you can expand so the more successful you are, the more marketing, the more you have. I'll give you a real quick example of how this can show up in library land. Eli Nyberger was talking with one of his, he's at Ann Arbor District Library, and one of his members, patrons, whatever word you want to choose, came in, not user, and said, you know how I can use this system to find a book at this library? And Eli said, yes. You know how I can use this system to find a book at any of the other branches? And Eli said, yes. He goes, why can't I use this system to list stuff that's in my house? I'm perfectly willing to share it, so if someone comes in and finds a book I have, I'll drop it off the next day. Now, in a lending model, that makes no sense, right? Well, because they're your books, they're not our books, they're not part of the collection. But in a sharing model, it makes perfect sense. The more community members you can get to participate, the more resources you have to share. And not only can they share their stuff, their books, their pictures, their video, their audio, they can share themselves. They can share their expertise. They can share their time. They can share their viewpoints. They can share their perspectives. And so the library, instead of thinking of it as a collection which has limited resources, if you think of it as a platform that allows people to do lots of stuff, it gets really interesting. Right? Libraries have their own resources, but they also then become a conduit for community resources to be spread around and shared. Here's the important part of a platform. Librarians don't control every input to that platform, and they don't control every output to that platform. So we worked on a system with Polaris called Community Profiles. And the original idea was you probably all have either at an academic or school or whatever, you know, the brain box where you have the quick Rolodex or electronic version so you can point people to different resources. Here's for community blood banks. Here's health and human services. Here's et cetera. And they were going to put that online. Yay. But then we started saying, well, if we put that information online about community organizations, can't we have the community organizations put their own information into our catalog system? I mean, they have a much greater vested interest in keeping it up to date. And they can include their own resources in it. And then not only could we let community organizations do this, but we could let individuals do this. We could let people come in and share what they have and the classes they want to teach or materials or things like that. One of the first reactions when we went out to libraries was the librarians going, and who is it that's going to enter this data? And we said, well, you can do it, or you can let the community organization do it. Oh, We couldn't let the community organization do it. They wouldn't know how to do it. We said, it's a web form. They'll figure it out. But it becomes back to this control issue. But let's for a moment think about the American Red Cross puts in when their blood drive is, health information, all this other stuff. And then what happened was there was a doctoral student up here at Syracuse University who said, I'm building an iPad app, and I'm gonna bolt these iPads onto our buses throughout the city. And what you're going to be able to do is say, I'm at this bus stop. What's happening near me? And it's going to pull this information from the library. And not only is it going to pull, well, there's a library here, or there's an information literacy seminar, library information. But with this community portal, they can also say, but there's also something happening in the arts, and there's a blood drive, and there's whatever. And what I like about this is if you think about that for a moment, the information going in that may be pulled up by this app didn't come from the library. The app that's pulling this information didn't come from the library. But the system wouldn't work without the library. The library becomes the crucial glue, the infrastructure that allows the community to work together. Right? We always sort of fight this idea with budget cuts that, you know, are we part of Parks and Recreation or are we part of the police force? And I would argue, you know, are we a necessary service or a nice addition? Right? Same in tuition. Are we teaching people in the classroom or are we, you know, administration? What are we? Well, I think we're sort of up with the roads. We're infrastructure. We're vital infrastructure. If you want to continue to share and get access to computing and resources, you need the library. In Chattanooga, Tennessee, they have fiber going all over the city. Massive fiber. The city put it in. And they went back to the city agency that networked them and said, now what are we going to do with it? And they said, I don't know. So they went to the library and they said, all right, you're in charge of the content material on here. And it's not what the library can purchase, and it's not what the library can license. It's the idea of then bringing the community in to share their information with the rest of the city. The content is going to be generated from the library, but not by the library. That's what a platform does. And this isn't just about technology. I want to give you sort of three other quick examples of library as platform. The first is sharing expertise. So in Fayetteville Free Library, right outside of Syracuse, they had the first makerspace. And one of the things they had is they had a 3D printer. So you could go in, you could feed it a computer file, and out it would print a nice object of some sort. And they started offering workshops. And so they'd bring kids in, and one of the first workshops they offered in sort of this hacker makerspace world was something called, BristleBots. BristleBots are where you take toothbrushes, and you lop off the bristles at the front, and you tape onto those old pager vibrating motors and a battery, and they jump across the stage. They move along. They're bristle bots, and you can race them, and it's very exciting. Well, this session was not going well, because what happened was they figured out that the watch batteries they bought could last about a minute and a half before they would run out of power. And meanwhile, they were showing kids the 3D printer, and the kids were saying, well, can you print me out a bunny? And then they print out a bunny and they're like, how long does it take? About 20 minutes. And it's only that small and it's not smooth and it's not multicolored. And so, and the librarians were sort of going a little nuts going, this is falling apart on us. What they didn't notice was that suddenly all the kids that were back with the bristle bots suddenly said, you know, we have AA batteries and we have duct tape. And they were taping like four toothbrushes together and getting these batteries and chasing them. And, oh, this is a bristle tank. And they were fighting it. And they were having a brilliant time. And it suddenly dawned on all of us, including the parents that were there, that the way this works is not that the librarians are experts in makerspaces and we provide a service where these people consume, but that these kids are experts in experimentation and we're providing them a place to do it. I've looked at their great relationships now between the Association of Library Services for Children and Lego, where they're going to put Lego spaces in. And the idea is not to come in and teach kids how to do Legos, it's to let kids come in and build Legos. Our libraries need to be more like that. I think all too often when we plan services, we come up with these assessment and evaluation metrics that really all come down to how am I going to keep from screwing up? As a librarian, how am I going to keep from being sued? And what we need to think about is what potential energy am I putting into a space and let the community come in and exploit it. Another one, Eureka Public Library in Eureka, Illinois, itty-bitty Eureka, Illinois in the southern part of the state. They had a woman come in and say, there's not enough places to eat lunch in Eureka. There's like one place and that's it. And I happen to be a trained commercial chef who just moved into the area and I'd like to start serving lunches. I think there's a potential business here. And rather than the librarian saying, well, here's a book on business plans and here's a, we can get, you know, here's a service to call. The librarian said, you see that corner of our lot? Why don't you set up there on Tuesdays? And they did. And suddenly Tuesdays became Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays, and suddenly a commercial, she had enough money to buy a commercial kitchen, and she was catering and providing services. Here, what happened was you had a community desire to get into business, a community need, food, and a library that made it happen not because of what a library planned as a service, but because the library was there as a space, as a platform for innovation that they didn't anticipate or control. In North Onondaga Public Library, Meg Bacchus and her husband, Tom Goki, brilliant people, they had a lot of desire from people who wanted to learn about gardening. And rather than having a discussion on gardening or buying gardening books, they looked outside and they said, hey, look, all we need is a hose and a hoe. And they went and they created gardening spots, and they'd loan out gardening spots and built a community garden. Not only that, but when they had, you know, tomatoes, everyone in August has way too many tomatoes, they started learning about local food sourcing and how to give that food up to food co-ops and food pantries and such. And they built a community activity that was impossible without the library, but wasn't about the librarian controlling that space. That's what we're talking about when we talk about community. Now, one question that people often ask about this is, why is that a library? Why isn't that a community center? Why isn't that, you know, anything else? Why does it have to be a library that does it? And what is my role as a librarian in that? Well, the reason that it's a library, and the reason is because librarians are involved. Remember, they named the building after us, not the other way around. The reason is because of our mission. The mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. All of those examples from setting up food, setting up gardening, setting up makerspaces, all of those are facilitating acts. And all of those are helping people learn. And reading. For years and years we've been about reading, but we're not been about reading. This is my big thing. I don't love to read. I love what I read. The idea here is that libraries allow you to go in and to explore and to develop. And what's amazing is libraries, we're realizing that once those readers read a lot, we can not only help them connect to other reading, but when they turn to a desire to write, when they turn to a desire to produce, when they turn to a desire to create, the library needs to be there as well. It's not just at the point of, Joan Fry Williams, I think, said it best. She said, libraries need to move from grocery stores to kitchens. Grocery stores are where you go and you get all the raw materials and you leave to do your work. Kitchens are where you produce the meal. Libraries need to be where they produce the meal, the video, the idea, the next thought, the next great thing. Libraries as engines of innovation. And this is where we need to move from and reject the deficit model. Think how exciting it is to talk about with your provost, with your board, with your mayor, with your principal, whatever. Think about the exciting conversation you have about what the community can be, about creating and new things and not what's wrong with the community. Instead of focusing on we help remedial education, we are a place where people can come read books because they can't read well, to this is where people come to read to get inspired, to come up with whole new ideas, new adventures, understand their place in the world. This is a place where people don't come to get a class in making space. This is a place where they come to make. This is a place where you don't simply come to get a book and leave. This is a place where you come to be a community, to create the community, to dream. That is such a more powerful message. It's like talking about why you became a librarian. Did you become a librarian because it was the default choice? Or did you become a librarian so you could serve people or engage in a fascinating world of information? Or what is it? What inspires you? The library needs to be an inspiring place, not a remedial place. We need to think about internet access not as this is a place where people can't afford internet access and get it, as to this is a place where people can use the internet to learn about the world and to shape the world. We need to reject a consumer model. We need to get out of the idea that this is a place where people come and buy books, or rather, they come here because they can't afford to buy books, or we're cheaper, we're the Walmart of the information world. Get rid of it. You're not a consumer. I'm not a consumer. We're human beings in charge of our own world, able to shape that world. We need to talk about the idea of generating not consumers, but generating citizens. Generating not graduates, but generating scholars. We need to talk about a place that inspires people. The library has a romantic ideal behind it that we need to build upon. And that romantic ideal is getting lost in the stacks. But it's lost in your own thoughts and your new ideas and your creation. That's our message. Our message isn't you're broken, we can fix you. Our message is we can help you be more. You need to expect more out of libraries. We need to make a new promise. We must make a promise with our communities. That promise is to help them participate in the full scope and scale of today's society. To not simply help unemployed find a job, but to find meaning and respect. To not simply help the student get to college, but to do so without the shackles of crippling debt. To not simply inform the citizens, but empower them to govern themselves. The promise we must make with our communities is that we are not consumers, we are not customers. We are not an audience to democracy, we are the democracy. We are the market. We consume, yes, but we produce, and we matter. This community, this city, this state, this country matters, and we will shape its destiny. And we, librarians, are essential forces of that promise. We are not obsolete, we are not quaint, we are not out of date. We are the promise for a better tomorrow. The reason we have libraries is not to collect things, is not to share things, is not to build a building. It is a place for the community to aspire to something greater. It is a place where people come to be better. And as librarians, we become the handmaidens of that innovation and that improvement. That is the message we need to take to our communities, not simply what we can do to fix problems. Thank you very much. And we